Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Today, we are going to talk about this book called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution by Dr. Arthur Eckstein. R. Eckstein is professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland College Park, author of the book we're talking about, Bad Moon Rising. And Art, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Mark.
And when Susie sent me the book and said, told me about this book, I said, do I want to do this? Yes, I do want to do this. let me just take way step back in history for our listeners. So this was a significant piece of our history in the late 60s, early 70s, the Weather Underground, and we came bubbling up doing Obama's first campaign for presidency because he apparently a fundraiser took place at Bel Air and Bernadine Dorn's home. Right. Right. But take us back to that moment and a feel for why you did this book and what you were looking for and what that period meant.
Well, the book was sort of accidental. I had a friend who suggested to me that I give a lecture on the conflict between the new left and the counterculture. He knew that I had been a hippie.
I can stop you. So even for our listeners, because I have a lot of young listeners, may have no idea what this new left thing even means, right?
Okay, so the new left were the radicals in the 60s who had sort of rejected the old-fashioned Communist Party of the USA as too staid and sort of stodgy, and were motivated both by opposition to the Vietnam War and by opposition to black oppression. And the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was the main organization through which the new left, as it was called, expressed itself versus the old left. The old left was the Communist Party, basically, and its offshoots. I had been involved at Berkeley in anti-police riots. I'd thrown my share of rocks at cops, but basically I was a counterculture person, not a political person. Mm-hmm. And in those days, in the late 60s, people divided the left on campus between the politicos and the hippies. So I was a hippie. So a friend of mine who had arranged for me to give a lecture, and he thought it would be very interesting for me to look back on those days, to go back to my youth, and to discuss the conflict, such as it was, between the new left, the politicos, and the hippies. And so I started working on this, and I'd always been sort of interested in weathermen, and this was about 2012, 2013, and it turned out that more than one weather person had published memoirs. And what I discovered in the memoirs was that there was a conflict in the memoirs between Bill Ayers' version of weatherman history, which was a sort of smiley face version of history. We never did anything wrong. We were only vandals. And these darker images that emerged from Mark Rudd's book and from Kathy Wilkerson's book and from other people's memoirs. So that was pretty interesting. And then a colleague of mine said, yeah, that's pretty interesting. But if you want to find out what happened, you ought to go to the National Archives, which are on the campus of the University of Maryland at College Park. And I said, okay, which meant no. So then he personally went to the archives, and then he called me up and said, now you really have to go to the archives. The FBI has just released 30,000 pages on weathermen. And so I went to the archives, and they brought out hand trucks of files. And the people at the archive also had provided a table of contents and had underlined which boxes were interesting. So I just pulled out the first box and just pulled out at random one of these FBI files, and it's actually in the book. That file says it's complaining about the failure of the FBI to catch any weather person. And it says, the problem is this, the file says. Generally, they are well-educated, frequently from upper-middle and wealthy backgrounds, sophisticated and intelligent. They do not draw upon criminal elements for support. We're dealing with dedicated communist revolutionaries who commit criminal acts, but our basic criminal techniques have not been productive against them. That was the very first thing I ever read.
Interesting.
And they were worried because it set the weathermen set a model for people to do things. What they were saying was the problem is weathermen are not criminals and don't associate with criminals. The way the FBI usually works is criminals associate with criminals, and then you have this kind of periphery where the FBI can put pressure on people on the periphery of some organization, bribe them or threaten them to turn informant. And the FBI had no informants in Weatherman after April 1970.
So let's take it back. This is a couple of interesting pieces you point out here. I mean, that particular moment in history, the Vietnam War was raging.
Yeah.
Nixon had become president of the United States in 1968.
Right.
The Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Movement in general was being decimated by the police.
Right.
Murdered and put in prison and more.
Right.
And the Weathermen were kind of a real revolutionary faction of the Students for a Democratic Society, as you can describe, that decided that the only way we can do this is to go underground and fight the system. We can't
– To be guerrillas, to actually wage a war.
Right.
That is, not to protest, but to actually begin waging a war against the United States. I want to make a kind of general overview of this,
yeah,
if I could. There are two views of the movement in the 60s. One view is that the movement failed. And for those people who think the movement failed, those people often use Weatherman as a scapegoat. They said Weatherman, because it was violent, delegitimized the movement, the general movement, and caused the gradual collapse of the movement. And I don't think that's true, because insofar as the movement collapsed, it was collapsed by the Nixon administration doing two things. One, launching a series of conspiracy trials against the leaders of the movement, of which the Chicago conspiracy trial, the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial, is only one of about eight that was done. The government never proved any of their cases of conspiracy. It didn't matter. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to distract the leadership in defending themselves. That was one thing that the Nixon administration had done. And the other thing that they did was to take away the major issues of the New Left by fulfilling the New Left's desires. That is, withdrawal from Vietnam, abolishing the draft. Nobody had ever thought about abolishing the draft. Nixon abolished the draft. Institution of affirmative action, and whatever one wants to say about the Nixon's motives for doing it, which may have been evil, that is, he wants to split, make whites hate blacks even more, that was a way of dealing with the issues of oppression of blacks. So in that kind of huge, these huge events, Weatherman, which was never more than about 100 people, is nothing in terms of thinking about the collapse, if there was a collapse, of the movement. But for those people who think that the movement was a success, and that includes me, ultimately a success, narrowly a success because, after all, Nixon did withdraw from Vietnam under pressure from the movement. And as he makes clear, that's why he did it. But also culturally a success in terms of black rights, gay rights, Hispanic rights, women's rights. All of these things that have occurred in the last 50 years, which have profoundly changed the country, Hispanic rights, Asian rights, Weatherman's violence, such as it was no impediment to that progress. So that means that Weatherman has been a sort of scapegoat. It's not that they didn't do bad things or intended to do worse things, and they were pretty violent. But when one thinks about them, one has to realize that the myth is bigger than the reality.
So there's a lot here. And I mean, one of the things you said, I'm going to get into the Weathermen and what they actually did and who they were and where they've all ended up now, which I find pretty interesting. Everybody's getting older and establishment figures themselves, but sort of establishment figures in quotes.
I mean, that's exactly true. When Ayers met Barack
Bill Ayers, we're talking about.
Bill Ayers met Barack. He was one of the leaders, one of the big three leaders of the Weatherman. When he met Barack Obama, it was after he had been named Chicago Citizen of the Year in 1997 for bringing $40 million to any inner city schools.
I'm a distinguished professor of education.
Yeah, sure.
So, and I know Bill very well. He's been on the show many times.
Yeah.
But coming, going back for a moment, because I do want to explore that and why the FBI could never, ever infiltrate and end the Weathermen. They couldn't get in, whereas they got into the Black Panther Party and destroyed it. They did not
get
inside the Weathermen, which is
an
interesting phenomenon that we should talk about a bit. But one of the things one of the really important pictures you paint here is as you were describing Richard Nixon's insidious reasons for supporting affirmative action or environmental legislation.
Also, environment also. Right.
And ending the war in Vietnam. It comes almost, if you want to do it in kind of Abrahamic theistic language, is almost like evil and in the White House, right?
Yes.
And what they plotted. So talk a bit about that, because that plus the FBI thing, which we'll get to in a moment, I think is very relevant to what's happening. I kept reading this book and thinking about 2016, not just 1970.
Right. I think the part of the book that deals with the FBI shows that the FBI's myth is also much bigger than the reality. The FBI was always a heavily factionalized group, especially in the 1970s, as Hoover was well over 76, 77 years old. There's maneuvering to who is going to succeed the old man, and there's bitter competition for that's going on. The way that one got ahead in the FBI was by arresting people. And part of the problem was that Nixon was demanding, and Hoover too to some extent, find Weatherman, because what they did was they put up wanted posters all over the country with the 13 or Weatherman leaders, all these young kids. You could see they were just young kids. And those posters went up in mid-1970, and by mid-1972, exactly zero of them had ever been arrested. The FBI motto was, "We always catch our man."
Right.
They had not caught anyone. It was a complete failure. And part of the reason was that they could not infiltrate Weatherman, the Weather Underground, because the Weather Underground consisted of small groups of people who had known each other for years. So that Weatherman security was just excellent. Meanwhile, Nixon came into office determined to destroy the left, the new left, put pressure on the FBI from the very beginning, from early 1969 when he became president, to do that, and in particular made it excellently clear that he didn't care if illegal methods were used to do this. That is, burglaries and wiretaps without court order. So that from the time that Nixon became president, the FBI leadership was under pressure to find these people, to destroy them, and Nixon made it clear that he did not care what kind of methods were used. And the odd thing about this is that J. Edgar Hoover, who is certainly an evil person in his own right and has lots of problems, was not willing to do this. He was certainly running his own illegal operations against the New Left. That's COINTELPRO New Left, it was called, the counterintelligence program against the New Left. But he felt that what Nixon was demanding was too big, that it would come out. The scale of what Nixon wanted was so large that it could not be hidden. It would come out, and when it came out, the mood in the country would not support it. So he was sort of opposed to this. And to that extent, I mean, in terms of 2016, there hasn't been anything like what Comey has done in the last 2 weeks ever in the FBI. Even Hoover's attack on Martin Luther King was secret. It wasn't stuff that was released at the time. The mantra in the FBI was "Don't embarrass the bureau," and I think Comey has embarrassed the bureau by what he's doing in a way that Hoover would not have approved of. It's not that Hoover wouldn't have enjoyed doing the sleazy tricks that were going on, but he always did it in secret, and this kind of blatant politicizing he would not have approved. And so, in the book, the odd thing is, I want to say also about this.
That's right. Good.
That Nixon was already a pretty paranoid person when he came into office. But in March of 1970, he was told three times in a single day, and once by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that the weatherman intended to assassinate him.
The New York senator.
Yes,
He was Nixon, but an advisor to Nixon.
He was the chief domestic counselor, other than Ehrlichman, to Nixon. And this is a written memo that says weatherman intends to assassinate you. Nixon was really, really upset about this, and he asked Irving Kristol, the father of Bill Kristol, the neoconservative, to come down from New York, from NYU, to talk to him about that. And Irving Kristol also says, they are going to kill you, because that's what these groups, these middle-class student groups, always do. They want to assassinate the czar like they did in Russia in the 1880s, and that's what they're going to do to you. And we know how upset Nixon was about this because of an FBI memo, which I discovered, which shows that as soon as Professor Kristol left, he gets around his aides and said, they're going to kill us all. And that puts pressure. Then he says, and the FBI isn't doing anything about it.
One of the things you say here, it's just really interesting, is to show the arguments inside the government, because Nixon, of course, we all know, was thrown out of office, impeached. You write in here, you say, despite what Hoover had ordered the Bureau to do against the radicals, his foot dragging and refusal to endorse a blank check for the use of illegal means of intelligence collection permanently soured his relationship with Nixon, who then – he got this from Haldeman's diary, John Haldeman, one of his other major advisors, Nixon's, and John Ehrlichman as well, would corroborate later, as you write, that it was actually the – anybody who knows that history – I didn't know this, and it's mind-blowing to think that J. Edgar Hoover is saying, no, we don't want to use a black box. We don't want to go do illegal things and wiretap illegally. Right. That was just pretty shocking.
It's amazing. Nixon, by February of 1971, wanted to get rid of Hoover. He maneuvered both in the spring of 71 and then in the fall of 71 to do it, and he could never do it. And it's because Hoover just had too much political weight behind him. Nixon was afraid to just fire him. But also because he himself, Nixon, was a shy person, and he didn't want to have to confront Hoover personally. He could not do it emotionally to do it. And then luckily,
which was not an easy thing to do, period, to confront Hoover personally.
To confront Hoover, it's not something I'd want to do, no. And then Hoover did him the favor of dying in May of 1972, and then they Nixon immediately puts into control of the FBI L. Patrick Gray, who had no background in law enforcement, no background in the FBI, and was a Nixon honcho, and it was in that way that Nixon got control of the FBI. And once L. Patrick Gray was in control of the FBI, the number of burglaries and illegal wiretaps goes up exponentially. Although I have to say, when all is said and done, the amount of illegal operations and interference in people's private affairs is minuscule compared to what goes on today on an hourly basis. I mean, the L. Patrick Gray program against Weatherman resulted not in anyone from Weatherman ever going on trial, but from high FBI officials going on trial in 1980. That's Mark Felt, Deep Throat, and another one of his people, Ed Miller, for a grand total of 13 unauthorized burglaries against not Weatherman, because they couldn't find Weatherman, but supporters and relatives of Weatherman. 13 burglaries.
Like, as you had Jennifer Dorn, Bernadine's sister.
That's right.
Bernadine Dorn's sister.
Bernadine Dorn's sister, the parents of Judy Cohen, the brother of Howie Machtinger. I mean, all of this stuff. And the result of all of this was a grand total of 13 burglaries. 13 interferences in private email goes on every second under the new rules, the post 9/11 rules.
So, but they had their root here, I think.
Yes.
The things I think about it, this is the root of what we're facing today.
Oh, yes.
Is in this moment in history.
Yes. It was Nixon who wanted to establish a Homeland Security department, bringing together all of the intelligence agencies under one roof. And Hoover was against that, too. He wanted to maintain the independence of the FBI.
It was interesting when you talk about the FBI not being able to crack into Weatherman collectives, and as you write in the book, yeah. I mean, because they were such a tight-knit little group.
Right.
That had people around them might have supported them, but they were very tight to get – very tight, and then all knew each other forever for 5, 6, 7, 8 years
That's
before
right.
this took place, which was different than the Panthers or the American Indian Movement, which were popular organizing groups and open that could easily be infiltrated and decimated right. from the inside.
I talked to someone who was the counterintelligence person for the African National Congress. And he knew a lot about Weatherman. He knew a lot about Weatherman. And he said, you know, Weatherman security was perfect. The ANC's security was terrible. We were constantly being infiltrated by the South African government.
Yeah.
But that's because Weatherman was tiny and we were big. And Weatherman accomplished nothing and we accomplished a lot. And that is, we were willing to accept infiltration by the government as the cost of doing business. And he said, I admire Weatherman security, but where, you know, it's 100 people.
And by the mid-70s, the Weathermen became really irrelevant.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They are a dangerous group for maybe 90 days at the beginning of 1970, and then they're just doing a protest bombing in a bathroom every 6 months. One can ask why their reputation is so high when, in fact, they did very little.
And your answer is?
My answer that is that they are the FBI is partly responsible for their huge reputation because they were on the most wanted list for years. Then you have a group of people who are really good. All the Weather people are all people who went to good universities. They're all well educated. They're all very, very, very good writers. And they start writing their memoirs. And Hollywood is interested in this because it's dramatic. They're certainly dramatic. They did spectacular things. They bombed the Capitol of the United States, the Capitol building. They bombed the Pentagon. The men's room. They bombed what's usually the women's room. Actually, they used.
I thought it was the men's room in the Senate.
That's one, but in the Pentagon, it's a women's room.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. It was your book, and of course you're right. Yes.
Right. And they bombed the State Department. So there were spectacular things that they did, but these spectacles were separated by year and months and months at a time when there was nothing that they were doing. And, of course, that made it easy for them to hide if they were doing nothing. But the spectacle was certainly part of it. And so you end up with people, you have the movie The Company They Keep with Robert Redford, who's playing Jeff Jones, in fact, who you and I both
know very well.
And, there's Robert Redford playing someone who has given up essentially on – and that's a movie from 2012. And you said, why would anybody care about a group of 100 people who stopped being politically important in the summer of 1970?
Well, we'll come back to that. Yeah. Hold that thought. We're here talking with Arthur Eckstein. Art Eckstein is a professor at the University of Maryland, a history distinguished professor. He wrote the book Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Power!
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and podcast at steinershow.org for all of you who want your friends to be able to listen to this later. And we're talking with Dr. Arthur Eckstein, who is professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland College Park, who's written the book Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. And one of the things that really strikes me here is, and you touched on a little bit beforehand, and it's kind of very important for our political process, is that you talk about the dysfunction inside the Weather Underground. Right. And we can talk a bit about that. And some of us who knew them thought that dysfunction was probably – knew that might have been going on because they were dysfunctional before they got there. But
that's also true. That's right.
But also there's a lot more very cool people and good people. But that dysfunction wasn't just about people and movements. That dysfunction, the way you write about it, was at the heart of the federal bureaucracy, the FBI, the Department of Justice. Right. It's just as dysfunctional as anything else. And that comes out glaringly in this book.
Right. The FBI was as factionalized as Weatherman was. And part of the amazing thing is that insofar as Hoover urged his henchmen to go after Weatherman, there was great resistance within the FBI to doing this for a very simple reason. People in the FBI who want to go from being a special agent to being a special agent in charge to being an inspector to being an assistant director can only do that via arresting people and getting convictions. That is statistics that they had to have. The local special agents in charge who kept getting messages from first from Hoover and then from Gray saying, "We want you to devote enormous resources to hunting down Weatherman," resisted that. And they resist – and you wouldn't say, well, the FBI, how can anybody resist it? And the answer is people would get memos from the center and they'd ignore them. Then 6 months later, they'd get a message from the center saying, well, how many people have you assigned to Weatherman? And it would be the same 12 that they had assigned. And that would cause a furor. And the reason was that it was a dry hole in terms of people's careers.
Because they couldn't arrest
them. You couldn't block their bombings. You didn't know when they were going to occur. You couldn't find where they were because they were hidden very well. I think it's hard to imagine how lackadaisical things were in this country in 1970. Lots of states had driver's licenses with no photographs. So that
In the late 60s, early 70s, it was so easy to create a false ID.
Absolutely.
It took nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, just took researching people who maybe were born in the mid 40s and died at birth. You get their birth certificate, and out of that, you create an entire identification for people all across the country. It was so easy to do.
It was easy to do. It was totally easy to do. I mean, it was also easy to buy dynamite. There were dynamite stores in Colorado and New Hampshire.
Right.
And in the book, but somebody was telling me. I went into a dynamite store in Colorado, and it said, "Hi, I'd like to buy 46 sticks of dynamite." And the guy goes, "Okay, here they are." And he says, "Well, don't you want me to sign for them?" And the guy goes, "Oh, yeah, well, put down something. You know, John Smith, I don't care."
Right.
That things were much more lackadaisical. It was also easy to bomb government buildings because government buildings did not have metal detectors.
Well, you write about in this book, you write about the weathermen going into police stations because there was no – one guy was at the desk, as you write.
An old sergeant sat at the desk and said, "Oh, we lost our bicycle." He said, "Yeah, go right in." right, and they're carrying the dynamite with them.
In the police station, everybody else.
Yeah, right. I mean – that shows America was much less security conscious. I mean, it's the same thing as saying that people were upset at 13 burglaries, that the entire country was much more innocent in those days than it is now in terms of issues of security.
And some of the FBIs you write in the book were actually indicted because of what happened in these black boxes, illegal kind of wiretaps and home invasions. Burglaries, I should say.
Yes, they were. Well, they were burglaries.
Right,
they were outright burglaries, and the FBI knew they were burglaries. And it's one of the things – one of Nixon's programs, the results to Hoover, there's a report that says, "Let's go ahead." And Hoover has footnotes saying this is illegal. That is, burglaries are illegal. He says opening people's mail is illegal. You can look and see what the address is from the person who sent it, but opening the mail without a court order is illegal. Really, they're just going to release 30,000 emails? It's outrageous.
I was just shocked reading your book, I was completely shocked that J. Edgar Hoover, the notorious head of the FBI, actually argued against opening people's mail and doing things without a warrant. I was just totally flabbergasted by that.
Well, I don't want to praise the FBI because obviously they're secret police. But one of the things that happened in the Miranda decision in 1966, which you get the famous thing, you have a right to a lawyer, you have the right to remain silent. That was FBI procedure under Hoover starting in the 40s and 50s. And that FBI procedure is quoted in the majority opinion on Miranda that's what should be done. On the other hand, Hoover was running illegal operations himself. He ran illegal operations against the Black Panthers, who he really hated. He ran illegal operations against supporters of Weather, but on a very small scale. And it's not that he didn't want to run things on a large scale.
He couldn't.
He sensed politically that if you did that, it would come out, because nothing is secret in Washington, despite what people might think. And if it came out, the blowback would be horrendous.
Yeah, all he could do was get people like me fired from jobs.
That's
what he could do back in the day.
But they did nothing illegal. All those guys did was go into your employer and said, by the way, you have a communist. That may be disreputable, but although they also were illegally tapping your – tell them the story about the other phones.
This was in 1968, I believe, and the Washington Free Press was moving around the corner, moving their offices. We were on Peach Street in D.C. Telephone people came in to disconnect the phones and move them out. They actually did those things in those days, and they did that. They came in. And when they were moving our phones out at the Washington Free Press, they said, do you want us to move the phones you have across the street? And we went, yeah, move those phones. And it was and it was the FBI had their phones tapping our phones.
They wanted to move everything, right? Have to move the whole.
And the rest of the story was there was a confrontation on the street because the FBI was coming into the building as they were coming out of the building. And they just kind of totally freaked out. They had this giant argument about what you're doing. We were just across the street laughing and moving our stuff. But, yeah, they did that stuff all the time. They were almost like a clown show sometimes.
Right. I would say there are serious things that the FBI did. I mean, they,
very serious
they,
things.
And
very serious.
One of the things, and I suppose it's the most startling fact in Bad Moon Rising, is that the FBI actually played a role in the rise of Weatherman.
This is really – as you say this, I'm going to say when I read this in this book as well, I had no idea this took place.
Right.
And it just blew my mind when I read the story of what the FBI actually did inside of SDS to make the Weather people be the ones in control. Tell that story. That's a really blew my mind.
It was a mind-blowing thing when I discovered this memo itself. In the spring of 1969, the FBI had about 100 civilian informants in SDS. These are different from agents. They had no agents in SDS because Hoover demanded that agents have short hair and wear business suits and Florsheim shoes and all that. And nobody's going to mistake somebody who's wearing Florsheim shoes for somebody who's an SDS student. It's not going to happen. But they did have about 100 civilian informants. And I discovered a memo which says – there's going to be a meeting at the National Convention of SDS in June of 69 in Chicago, and we want the civilian informants that you have – this was actually in San Francisco and Cleveland – to go to those conventions as delegates and not simply observe and send back information to us, but to vote. And you are to vote – they are to vote for what was called the National Office – which was Weatherman, the origins of Weatherman, against the Progressive Labor Party. The Progressive Labor Party was the other faction in SDS, and they believed actually they were very disciplined. They were Marxist-Leninists,
Maoists,
and they believed that it would take years of propagandizing the working class to create the revolution. And the view in the FBI was that's the really dangerous revolutionaries. As they said, the National Office is a bunch of stupid anarchists. Nobody's going to follow them. They're not really a threat. The FBI informants should back them. And that's what happened at the convention in which SDS was taken over by Weatherman when Bernardine Dorn led this famous march of 700 people to create the real SDS, that is Weatherman SDS, and split SDS in half. Doing that, several dozen at least of the people who followed her out of to create the new SDS were in fact FBI informants and who were operating under orders. And this memo that we have boasts about that. It said, we helped split the SDS and destroy it as an organization. And then they say, and it's weird, but Weatherman is becoming more and more extreme in order to keep up with PL. And that's fine with us because they're both isolating themselves from the mass of the movement. And this is an excellent COINTELPRO operation.
And I think that was emblematic of what they did in organizations across the country and how they split groups and destroyed them. And
that's right.
Whether it was the Panthers and the stuff came out about Geronimo Pratt, who spent 27 years in prison, an L.A. Panther, and came out later in revealed documents that he didn't do anything. It was 400 miles away when this took place that he tried to say nobody paid attention. And they were paying attention. They put him in prison and completely set him up. That happened over and over again, over and over again.
Yes, it did. And so this is actually an example. But the reason that the FBI did this was they underestimated the danger of Weatherman. They said, well, Weatherman is a bunch of anarchistic students. They're not really very important, so let's back them. Then when Weather actually began the war and went underground and were preparing to do bombing, then the FBI, who now had no sources within Weatherman because they were this small group, overestimated their danger and said, Weatherman consists of 1,000 guerrillas and 5,000 direct supporters. And this is what Time magazine was told by the head of FBI domestic intelligence. It said 1,000 guerrillas. It was 100. It says 5,000 direct supporters and tens of thousands. You know, and they were off by a factor of 10. So the FBI panicked over this. And that's why you get the wanted posters, because that's what they really thought. And that's what they were telling Congress also. And, of course, along with that, they said, well, you know, the threat to the government is so serious that we need more money. We need more agents. We need more appropriations.
And they got them.
And they got them. But then they were stuck with the fact that, okay, you have all these wanted posters. You haven't caught any of them.
So coming back to the beginning of some of this stuff, I want to come back to the FBI here. In the beginning, the thing that I think most people know about the Weather Underground, if it sticks in anybody's head at all, from the late 60s, early 70s, was the explosion in the townhouse.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And the early days of the Weathermen going underground and what that explosion meant.
Right.
That really gripped the nation and New York, because it happened right?
Yes, it gripped New York, yeah. The media center of the world, right. And that was a very dramatic event. So if you're saying, why is Weatherman famous? They're famous for the townhouse explosion in which three Weatherman leaders were killed.
Which was an accident.
It was an accident. They blew themselves up.
Right.
As they were preparing lethal bombs for an attack on an enlisted men's dance in Fort Dix, New Jersey, and the bombing of the Capitol, the bombing of the Pentagon, the bombing of the State Department. But the reality is that those bombs were all – not the townhouse bombs, but the other bombs were small bombs. They're separated by years between them. So it's – you know, to go back to why is Weatherman famous – they did these things which are pretty spectacular, but also Bill Ayers was just a genius at public relations. He always was, and still is. and the PR, and they had great PR. I would say that's really true. But the key thing to think about all of this is that once the townhouse explosion happened and people were actually killed, the people in Weatherman had to face the reality of if they really were going to set off a revolution, that meant killing people. And while there were some people in Weatherman who were prepared to do it, it turned out that most people were not. And a few months later, out in California, there's a meeting of the Weather Bureau in Mendocino, which is a society.
This is important. If you're looking at the history of what happened in the revolution movement in the early 70s, this is a very pivotal moment.
It's May 1970. The campuses are exploding. The students have gotten shot and killed. And it's at that point that Weatherman says, we're not going to kill anybody. And those who are in favor of lethal operations are expelled or demoted in the group. And why would they back off? You know, the anti-war movement was a double anti-war movement. It was anti-Vietnam, but it was also anti the war that Weatherman was thinking about doing in its desperation because things had gone so bad in the country. And the movement people told Weatherman, do not kill. They said that is their constituency was telling them not to do this. They said, if you kill, you will be alone. The most radical underground newspaper in the country, the Berkeley Tribe, was saying that to them. Tom Hayden, who just died unfortunately, wrote a very important article in Ramparts in 1970, in the summer of 1970, saying, do not do this. They said, if you kill, you'll be alone. If you don't, you'll have a lot of support. And the problem with, I hate to say it, revolutions cost blood, and Weatherman backed off from that. And then the real radicals in Weatherman said, if you back off, then you're just a protest organization. And that's what they wanted to be in the end, a protest organization, not real revolutionaries, because the idea of killing, they were very affected by the counterculture, which is a hero in the book, oddly enough, a book written by an ex-hippie. Guess what? It's the counterculture that's really great. That they, influenced by the counterculture and by their own constituency, they backed off from a real revolution and instead became a protest group. Admittedly, you know, it's not – they weren't just vandals. Using dynamite is pretty serious – is very serious stuff. But because they didn't kill, it was also the case that when it became clear there wasn't going to be a revolution, they were simply able to take the bridge back into mainstream society.
Which they did.
Overwhelmed. Right. Some didn't, but the overwhelming majority did. They were able to do that. I mean, Mark Rudd became a professor of mathematics.
Kathy Wilkerson taught mathematics in New York City schools.
She did,
as you write about as well.
And of course, her story as well. I didn't major in mathematics in college, but in order to build bombs, I had to learn mathematics, and turned out I liked mathematics. I became a math teacher. So, I mean, this is another part of the story that these people came back to society. None of them changed their spots. They're all way on the left, but they're living peaceably in a society which itself has changed in many dramatic ways. And I hate to say it, but Bad Moon Rising sort of has a happy ending, except for a couple of people. But it has a happy ending in that, in the end, people came to a reconciliation. I mean, you know, people were saying about Bill Ayers, Obama's palling around with a terrorist. That was Sarah Palin was saying this stuff. He wasn't a terrorist anymore. He hadn't been a terrorist for 40 years. You know, he was a professor, you know, and oh, yeah, he wrote books saying, let's reform education. Wow. You know,
I think the significant piece here when you look at some of the things you wrote about here, I was really taken by this with the memo that the man who took over in July 72 took over from J. Edgar Hoover.
Patrick Gray.
Yes. Yeah. And put this memo out and hunt the Weathermen and similar groups to exhaustion. He said it over and over again in this one memo.
Right.
And they really – the push here, they were just – they were – they couldn't get away from it. They were – I mean, it consumed their lives trying to find this group.
It consumed the lives of people like Gray, who was an agent of Nixon. They violated many laws in order to find these people and came up empty. So, for instance, Jennifer Dorn, the sister of Bernadine Dorn, her apartment was burgled 5 times in 1 year. What did they find? Her recipe for Indian pudding.
Right.
That's in the memos. They've got the recipe for Indian pudding.
Did you try it?
And apparently also as a souvenir for the head of domestic intelligence, a pair of her panties was taken as well. That was supposedly on his desk. The thing to say about all of this, one of the things that was amazing to see was a lot of the FBI people wrote memoirs. L. Patrick Gray did, William Sullivan, Mark Felt did. Those memoirs.
Who was Deep Throat, actually.
And who was Deep Throat.
And
a very important figure in American history.
Right.
Those memoirs are more filled with lies and are less dependable. Than the memoirs of the Weatherman memoirist, even Bill Ayers' memoir. That was a shocking thing to see, that I was able to catch all of these guys in outright lies. What do I mean by that? What they say is belied by the contemporary documents that are now in the National Archives. That is, they are the documents from 1970, the documents from 1971. For instance, Felt claimed that Sullivan proposed that the FBI prepare a list of 11,000 radicals, including you, to be, Mark, to be
right.
rounded up in case Nixon right. declared a state of national emergency.
Right.
And Felt says, and this was rejected in the FBI. No, it was not rejected in the FBI. The Council of Assistant Directors signed off on it, and it went to Hoover, and he signed off on it. And that's what would have happened if, again, Weather had engaged in lethal bombing. Nixon, who was obsessed with them, would have said national emergency. 11,000 leftists would have been rounded up, and the entire political history of the United States would have been different.
Completely different.
Completely different and much darker.
So let me conclude this way with you. So here we take ourselves 46 years later.
Yeah.
And many of the FBI agents are dead.
Right.
Passed away, I should say. Most of the Weather Underground is still alive. There are men and women in their 70s for the most part.
Right.
And they're community organizers, they're professors. So what is your, in reflection on this, takeaway now in 2016, 46 years later? You're a historian, and one of the things that we do – what historians do when we do our history is to understand the present is to understand our past. We can't do it without the past. So what is this teaching us, do you think? What are you trying to say here about what this says to us in this 21st century?
Well, the title of the book, Bad Moon Rising, could refer to the Weatherman because the Creedence Clearwater song was one of their anthems.
Right.
But it could also refer to the possibilities of the FBI acting badly. And what is clear from the book is how innocent 1970 was in terms of what people were already calling the national security state. It was nothing compared to what it is now. Absolutely nothing. It was an innocent time. They said it was really easy to get false documentation.
So
it was
easy.
Really easy to drop off the map, drop off the grid.
Yep.
The FBI failed to catch a single weather person. But in the process, they began to create the ideas for the Homeland Security Agency. They began to engage in illegal burglaries without court order and wiretappers and opening people's mail. That was a shock in the mid-70s when it came out. People were shocked. And again, that shock shows us how far we've come. Oh, my God, 13 burglaries when that sort of thing goes on every second nowadays. So we have a much more developed national security state now than we had then. And the bad moon in that sense is the rise of the national security state, the rise also of the imperial presidency that's going on with this. It's very hard to be an intelligence agency in a democracy. Those things go against one another. The FBI... now is doing things that Hoover would probably be shocked at.
That's amazing to even hear that being said. The book is Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost Revolution by Dr. Arthur Eckstein. Art, thanks so much for coming in the studio. Good to have you here.
It was a great pleasure for me to be here, Mark.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Now we got a revolution, cause I see the face of things to come.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Benery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramadan. Our engineer is Andrew Melton. And our intern is Morgan Sr. Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And please send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of the Mark Steiner Show, and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Get your foot off.